Hello, everybody. My name is Larry. I'm an alcoholic, and this is really cool. I'm going to start mine off. Kathy forgot her water. I'm going to remember mine. I get to come to this meeting all the time, and it's really nice to come to the meeting. I like to see the speakers when they come up here, and they open their bottle of water and say, excuse me. And they don't drip like I did, but I think it's because my lips are so big, you know, it's kind of hard to drip this down. That's not a joke, you guys. Wow, sure, there's a lot of people out there. Let me put this damn thing down. You know, I was talking to some friends of mine who told me to start some... I can't curse because I got a buddy back there that counts. Every time I talk or whatever, he counts the number of times I curse. And I'm really trying to change, and I want you to know, if I don't say anything else tonight that you hear, I really want you to truly hear something. And that is that I am truly grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to tell you from the bottom of my heart that I never, ever imagined ever in my life thinking that I would stand before a bunch of people like you and say that out loud. That wasn't in the cards for me. But you guys have grabbed me in a way that have, my whole life has changed, you know, and it's just amazing. You know, I'm already starting this, and I'm starting to get emotional because I get a chance to stand up here, and I don't know if you've had the opportunity, but it looks a lot different from standing up here and looking out that way than it is from out there looking this way. First of all, you see a lot more sets of eyes out there, you know, and it gets kind of nervous, especially when there are special people that are looking at me. I come from San Diego. This is where I was born in San Diego, and I'll tell you from the very beginning, as long as I can remember, that God never came into my neighborhood. I always felt all my life that there was, you know, if there was a God, I didn't know why he felt that it wasn't good to come into Southeast San Diego. But, you know, that's where I lived, and so I just understood that maybe it was working for you and not me, even though at an early age I did try to find it, because, see, my mother and father were both alcoholics. They drank all the time. I mean, all the time. And they, see, I after I've grown up, I've got a chance to see some others. My parents, they drank the high-class alcohol, you know, like the Ripple, the Gallo wine. And you know, then all of a sudden Mad Dog 2020 started coming into it. And I mean, the good stuff, you know. And I used to watch that all the time. And at any given day, any given night, at 2 o'clock in the morning, it'd be a toss-up if my mother would be chasing my father down the street with a baseball bat, or he would be chasing my mother. But it was always something like that going to happen in my house, you know. And so it was unbelievable. The cops would always come to our house, and they knew us by name. Larry, are you okay? Fred, are you okay? And it was so embarrassing, you know. And the neighbors would always be looking out the window, you know, at us, you know. But I lived in a good neighborhood. I remember looking back. And all these things now are like hindsight, because now I recognize the people who I saw and what was going on in their lives. See, but I thought, you know, because when I was growing up, we had this guy that lived up the street. We called him Red Dog Red. He looked Indian. He was always red. He was a light-skinned black man, but he was red. And he was really a weird dude. He was just crazy. And he had a brother, I think he was brother, but this guy was really dark-skinned, and we called him Uncle Bill. And Uncle Bill, I don't know why, well, the people that lived there, the kids that we ran around with, that it was their uncle, so he became our uncle too, you know. So anyway, Uncle Bill, but Red and Uncle Bill was always fighting, you know. We go out to their house, and we just sit in front of their house, and we sometimes throw rocks at the house to get them to come out and start yelling at us, because one would yell at us, another one would tell the other one not to yell at us, and then they start to fight, and we'd have a good time. And it was just so much fun, man. I tell you, you know, I mean, even though I had it bad, we had fun, man. It was a trip watching the people on my street, you know. And this old Uncle Bill, he gets so drunk, we'd be playing baseball, you know. We'd play him baseball, you know, with a tennis ball, but we'd be the Giants and we'd be playing the Dodgers. And Uncle Bill would always come and screw up our damn game, you know. But the friend of mine that lived on the corner, he had these... what are they called? Dotsons or Dostons? These little dogs. We call them really weenie dogs. The wiener dogs. He had a bunch of some wiener dogs, and they had puppies, and they would always attack Uncle Bill. You know, there was something about him that they would always attack him, and he'd fall on the ground, and he'd be screaming and hollering. He said, "They're killing me. They're killing." And we would just laugh. I mean, we'd have a good time. Now, after experiencing that very same fall, it's not so funny, you know, but. But Uncle Bill was just, it was just true. So that's how I grew up. I grew up in that type of atmosphere, and I went to school, and like I said, we never had anything. And I reflect back, and I think it's good for me to sometimes look back at where I came from, because it tells me that there's some changes that I need to make in my life to make sure that my kids, my children, don't ever experience some of the feelings that I felt. I was in the sixth grade, and it was a big time. You know, we were getting ready for that promotion where you go from the sixth grade to the seventh grade, and you get the little ribbon, and everybody signs your ribbon and everything, and it's great. And we were going to have this little play that we put on for the parents, and I had a nice role in it, you know, in this play. And on this particular day, they told us that we could have it. We had an extended lunch hour so that we could come to school in our regular clothes, play or whatever, and then we could go home and change clothes, so we'd be, you know, we look decent for the ceremonies. Well, unfortunately, because of the way we live, when I went there, I went to school with a pair of purple pants that belonged to my brother, and they were big, too big for me, so I had to bring them together, and I held them together with a bobby pin, one of my mother's bobby pins. On the shirt that I had was a green shirt. It was a light green shirt with dark green diamonds in it, and buttons were missing, and I had a safety pin to hold it together, and I was so embarrassed, but I had nothing else to do, so I had to go to school, and I had to roll into play, and so I went there, and I was terrible. I mean, I felt terrible. I felt so much less than everybody, and I hated my parents, because how could I go to school having a role in the play? They certainly weren't going to be there, because my mother and father never showed up, except when I was playing baseball, my father would show up, and then everybody would laugh at him because he would be drunk. But at this particular time, I'm at this ceremony, and we're playing kickball, you know, we got that extended lunch period, and I'm so embarrassed, but I'm going to make up some excuses why, oh, I forgot to go home, or I couldn't go home, it's too late. And I'll never forget that the vice principal of the school yelled out from way across the field. He said, "Hey, Larry, you still have time to go home and change clothes." And it was in front of all these kids, everybody that I knew. And I just felt so, I mean, I don't know if you hear me, but at the time, even right now, as I tell you about it, I still get that feeling of shame, you know. And anyway, I told him, I said, you know, I left home and I forgot my key and I'm locked out of the house and I can't get in the house. But, you know, that's what I told him, but that wasn't true. What was true, that I was wearing the best I had. I was wearing the very, very best I had. I want you to understand, though, that even though I'm talking about this and may mention my parents a little bit more, I want you to know that I believe today that my parents did the very best that they could. They really did. They were dealing with playing with the cards that they were dealt, you know, and they lived the way they lived. And I know that they made some sacrifices for us, you know. And so anyway, so it's time for this big production, you know, and there it was. Here was my turn. And I go out there and I'm getting ready to do my thing. And all of a sudden, cameras start flashing. People were taking pictures. And I knew in my little 11, 12-year-old mind that everybody was taking pictures of me so they could go and show everybody how bad I looked. I really, truly believe that. And I remember when it was over with, I didn't want to talk to anybody. I ran all the way home just crying and crying. And it was just terrible. But that's the way I grew up. And then what I did is I thought I would find religion. Out of the kids that I went through, they went to Catholic school, you know, and they, there was this thing called catechism. So I decided to go up to the church and I was going to join. I was going to talk God into coming to my neighborhood, you know. So I go up to this church and I'm going through this thing, and I don't even remember what it was. I would go to class and we sit there and they teach us. And then we went into the church, and in the church there was this glass thing and it had all these little crosses. I walked by there, you know, and I looked at the priest, and we went in the back, and then I came out, and then everybody left, and I looked at that case, and I went into that case, and I opened the back and I stole a cross. I stole a cross. It was a white cross with a gold Jesus on it. And I took it home and I told my mother that I had done real well and that the priest gave me this cross. And I was wondering, I asked my mom, would she hang it up? And she hung it up right over our door, and I just knew God was going to come to our neighborhood. But he didn't show up. And some other stuff started to happen in our house, and then the next thing you know, my father was gone. I didn't know where he was for a long time, and my mother was drinking and doing some terrible things, and things were just getting real bad, real bad. But I was always the one who wanted to fix it. My brother was older. I had a younger sister. And I always wanted to be the one to fix it. If my brother was crying about something because it was something he wanted, It was okay to give it to him. I could do without. And I would go out and steal bottles and stuff so that I could buy stuff for my little sister, because I didn't want anybody to look at her and laugh at her like they laughed at me, or I felt they were laughing at me. So I'll fast forward a little bit, and I'll tell you that my father did finally come home, and my mother and them used to fight. And like I said, sometimes when my father would chase my mother and down the street, my mother would yell for my brother to run, and my brother would curse at my dad, and my dad would throw something at him, and he'd go running, and my mother would yell and scream at me, "Come on, Larry, come on, get away from that fool." I just didn't have it in me. I would rather let my dad kill me than run from my dad. And I used to stand there and look at him. I used to say, "Dad, why are you doing this?" And he would look at me, you know, and he just say, "Get in the house, Larry, get in the house," you know. And he never bothered me. My mother and father, they never bothered me. And I never ran. I couldn't run. I didn't think I didn't know much about life, but I just knew something was wrong with that. Something was wrong with my household. Something was wrong with my environment, you know. And I remember coming into an AA meeting after I got in here, and I'm going to be bouncing back and forth. But I remember, and Barney M was speaking. I remember Barney said, you know, it was at the Easy Dozen speaker meeting. I never forget how he came. Big, powerful man. I just admired him. He came and he said, "You know what?" He said, "One day I just knew that there was a spaceship that was going to land on University Avenue. And when it landed on University Avenue, there was going to be three guys to come out of the spaceship and look just like me. And they say, 'Come on, Barney, we're going home.'" And I just knew that one day somebody was going to come and get me, because I didn't fit. It just didn't work. It wasn't right. And then what happened is I started looking at this stuff that my mother and father was drinking, and every now and then I'd sneak over and I'd grab a bottle or something, turn it up and drink it. And, man, that Ripple came in different flavors, man. It was some good stuff, you know. And my father had this stuff he called Shake 'Em Up, where he would get Gallo wine, little pot, you know. He wasn't that big time, so he'd get a little bottle. And he'd open it, you know, and he'd pop it first, he says, and then he'd take that cap off and kill the poison, is what he called it. I used to watch him and say, "Wow, that's cool." And then he'd put Kool-Aid in it. Man, I knew that was for me. So I sneak over and I drink it and I change. I don't know, you know, I became Alvin and the Chipmunks. I would joke and have fun and do things, and I would put on shows and everybody, "Look at Larry, ha ha." You know I was, you know, in hindsight, I was stupid as hell, but they thought it was funny. And then that was a part, that became a part of me, just doing things. You know, if people laughed at me, they wouldn't talk about me. And I started doing that, and you know, it just seemed that that stuff just, I became Superman when I drank, you know. And at 13 years old, I was smoking cigarettes and hanging out down at the park, and I spent more time at the park than anywhere else. And man, I was going to become a professional baseball player. I was going to really get good at it too, you know. And I made I made the Little League All-Star team, and man, was I proud. I made the All-Star team, you know. And we were getting ready for the first game, and I had this beautiful, it was the first year we got these brand new uniforms. They were powder blue with a gold star on it that said SE for Southeast. I was number 4. I was cool in the neighborhood. I'd wear my uniform to school so people would recognize, you know, I'm a baseball player. And so we go down and we're getting ready for our first game, and the coach, we had this guy who I guess he almost made it to the pros. He had a drink of coffee, I think, or a cup of coffee, what they say. And he was going to help us. He was going to take us all the way to Williamsport, Pennsylvania, he told the coach. And so the coach was listening to him, and they became good friends. And people admired this guy. He was a big dude, you know. And he was big then, and he's big now. He was 6'7", and he was a big dude. And we've had our encounters, and maybe I'll tell you about that. But anyway, here we are getting ready for the lineup. And he's saying what the lineup is going to be like, you know. And he says, "So I want so-and-so to bat first, and then Tyrone, you bat second." And when he said Tyrone bat second, I said, "Wait a minute, hold it, wait a minute. Tyrone and I play the same position, so if he bats second, that means I can't play." And he said, "Yeah, we want a left-hand batter." And I'm talking to him like, I had a question, I wanted to ask it. I said, "Wait a minute, but I'm the second base." He said, "No, we're going to start Tyrone. You're not even our coach. Well, how can you make the lineup? Because that was my position, I earned it." And he told me that I wasn't going to play, so I used some words that my mother and father would use to articulate something they felt. And my coach, as soon as I communicated with the man. My coach looked at me and told me to shut up. And the way he told me to shut up, I knew it wasn't good. And I looked at him. I said, but this is not fair. And so what happened, though, is that we proceeded on with our little thing. And we played 4 All-Star games. The second game, we beat Encanto. I'll never forget this. You can tell I'm into this, huh? Yeah. Oh, yeah. So we beat Encanto 25 to... Let me back up. They beat Encanto 25 to nothing because there was only one kid on that team that never got to play. And that was me. And I don't understand. I didn't understand it. You know, you were here throughout this little talk that there's a lot of things I just didn't understand. And I can understand how you could beat a team 25 to nothing and you not let one of the kids play. I mean, what kind of statement was he saying about me? And everybody was in the stands. And I know they were all sitting there saying, Larry didn't get to play. And I was just embarrassed. And again, I ran home crying. And I hated everything and everybody. But most of all, I hated my parents because they weren't there to watch. They weren't there to represent me. They weren't there to speak up for me. They wasn't there to protect me against that. So I decided that, you know, who needs to play baseball? Who needs to be a good kid? So I started doing things that I'm not proud of. And I did some stupid things, you know. And I hung out with some stupid guys. A lot of them who are in jail or some of them are dead. A lot of things I started doing as I started growing up. But I made it to high school. And when I made it to high school, like I said, I was going to become a professional baseball player somehow. But I didn't have the money to buy the gloves or whatever. And I remember I had this little crush on my 10th grade teacher. She was an English teacher. Man, was she pretty. All my partners used to tease me about it. But I swear, I don't like that lady. What are you talking about? She, you know, but I love that lady. It ain't like it is today, unfortunately, because I know, and this may get a little controversial, but I hear some things that's happening to those young guys out there by these beautiful teachers. I sure wish I had been a part of that back then. I'm not trying to get involved in any outside issues or anything, but I tell you what, I wouldn't have told anybody. Anyway, so here it is. This teacher, for whatever reason, she came up to me and she said, hey, Larry, someone said that you used to play baseball. And I was wondering, you know, the coach, Mr. He's looking for players. And I said, well, I can't do it. She said, why not? I said, well, because, you know, I didn't want to tell her because I was poor. I couldn't afford to play, you know. And so anyway, she said, well, why don't you just try out? And I said, okay. And that afternoon after school, I went down there and I started, and she was watching, so I wanted to show out, man. The coach started hitting me some ground balls, and man, I was backhanding them and flipping them. Man, I was so cool. I was just getting down. You know, she was watching, man. I was going to miss nothing. You know what I mean? I was out there to impress. And so anyway, so I'm doing this, and then I get up, he let me bat, and I'm just having fun. I could see the ball better for some reason, you know, even though every now and then I sneak a look to see if she was watching, you know, and then I go. But anyway, so the coach told me that what he would do, if I needed some money to buy the glove and everything, that what he would do is he'd help me out, but I needed to work for him. And I said, all right, so what are you saying to me? He says, well, let's get together on Saturday. You have to put a roof in, and if you help me put in the roof, I'll give you some money. You could buy your shoes and stuff. And I said, really? I said, all right, that's cool. And I'm not one who wakes up early, but on this morning I was up waiting for him to come to my house. And I certainly didn't want him to come up to the door and knock because I didn't want him to see what was inside. So when he drove up, I was coming out. And man, I was just excited. I was going to work and make this money and I was going to do this and I was going to impress this teacher. And so anyway, we get to his house and we climb up on the roof and drink some orange juice and eat some donuts. And I'm thinking, this roof ain't going to be get done by itself, and I don't know how to do it, so he better start teaching me. And so I'm sitting there, and then we're eating the donuts and everything because I can't tell him what to do. And then this lady pulls up, and she pulls up because it's his girlfriend, and they want to go get something to eat. And he says, come on, Larry, let's go get something to eat. And I'm thinking, now I'm starting to get cheated here. I got up early to come work, and now I'm going to eat. I know I'm not going to make the money he said I was going to make. Something's wrong with this. Again, I didn't understand. So we went and got something to eat, and then we went back and we climbed up on the roof. And now, you know, it's not easy to go to work after you've had a nice meal, but I was ready to do it. And then I said, well, what do you want me to do? And he said, you know, let's just get out of here. Let's just go. And And he started climbing down the ladder off the roof, and I'm looking at him and said, what the hell is this all about? You know, so I go up there and say, Coach, what's going on? He says, here, you know, and he reaches in his pocket. He gives me some money and tells me he's going to pay my insurance and everything, and my job is done. And I'm thinking, wow, this is cool. So I started playing baseball for Lincoln High School. I was a Hornet. And things were going to get better, I knew. And one night I went up to Lincoln High School, and I guess God sent somebody into my neighborhood, and I met my higher power. And she was about 5 feet, 6 inches tall. And at the time, she had these fishnet stockings on. I had never been trained. However, I didn't understand, but I felt good. And so what happened was that I started spending all this time with her and doing all the things we do. And she knew more than I knew, and we became real good friends. And the fast forward, of course, I played that 1 year baseball, and when the coach invited me back the next year to play varsity, which I really wanted to do, well, I was a little busy. And I was out. Now I had to make some money so I could get a car so she and I can hang out more, and we were doing these things. And so then I turned 19 April the 12th, and she turned 17 April the 6th, and we got married April the 27th because I was grown. And her family was something like mine, and I wanted to save her. But the real reason was because shortly thereafter, this little boy came along, and we called him Larry Jr. And I swore that never, ever was I going to allow a kid to come into this world and not have representation. That no one was ever going to separate me from a child of mine. And this was my little boy. His name was Larry Jr. And I was going to be there. But the problem was nobody taught me how to be a man. Nobody taught me how to be a father. Nobody taught me how to do that stuff. And now that Ripple and stuff was tasting better and better all the time. In fact, now when we have parties, we'd have parties all the time. And what we would do is get a big pot. And on certain days, it would be a brown night or a white night. A brown night means anything brown that you can get, any kind of alcohol that's brown, we pour into this pot and we drink it. Oh, man, that'd take you on a trip. When you talk about taking a trip, not taking a trip, well, I'll tell you something. And so I would always come up missing. I don't know what happened. Some people now, I hear them talking blackouts. I was having whiteouts. You know, it was just really strange. You know, I couldn't. And so what happened was that, so now I'm doing this. I got a job, but I can't hold the job down because I can't make it to work on time. And for some reason, I have cars that I can't find sometimes. I have no idea where I parked them or left them. They just disappeared, you know. I remember one time I was driving, and I was going down this street of Euclid by Euclid and Federal, which is usually a busy street. And I'm driving. All of a sudden, the wheel popped off or something because I didn't know that you take car in for servicing and stuff. I just put gas in it, and so I'm driving, and all of a sudden the wheel popped off, and it just took me all the way across the intersection up into the curb. And when I got out, the only thing I could think about was getting, I had a six-pack of beer in the back, and I wanted to get it out, and I didn't want the cops to take it from me, so I ran and left my car. I still don't know what happened to that car. You know, and it wasn't important. But I know what happened to that six pack, if you know what I mean. So anyway, I'm starting to do this. So now I'm grown. I got a kid, and so I'm married. I'm a married man with a son. And one morning, I'm sitting on my porch talking to some buddies of mine, and I got this mailman walks around the corner, and he has this brown envelope that says greetings. And I'm reading it, and they're saying, we want you, so to speak. You know, I forgot the wording, but it meant that. So I told all my buddies who were there laughing at me for being drafted that they couldn't do this to me. I'm Larry Dixon. I have a son. I'm married. They can't do this to me. So I went down there to talk to them about this. And so when I went to talk to them about this, I walked in. I told the lady, I said, you know, you made a mistake. She said, really? She said, what kind of mistake? And I said, well, I got these papers, I'm married, and I have a son, and I'm not going in. And she looked at it, she said, you know, that makes sense. You don't have to worry about that because you are married. We'll reclassify you. And she turned around to walk off and said, whoa, wait, hold it, wait a minute. What are you going to do? She said, we're going to reclassify you so you don't have to worry about that. And I said, well, just hold on for a minute. Let me have my papers back. And I took the papers, and I felt for some reason, I don't know why, but she just didn't want me. No fight, no argument. So I told her I wanted to think about it. And she looked at me like, what is it you want to think about? I said, I'll be back. And I left. I went and I told all my friends, I told everybody that the United States government was really cold. And even though I was married and had a kid, I had to go in anyway. And the reason why is because at that time I had this moment of clarity. You see, I haven't told you the whole story as far as what I was into. But I was drinking. I was doing some stupid things. And I kept hearing, well, make a man out of you. You'll see the world. So I was ready to make that move. I can tell somebody understands. So, all right. So what happened was that I decided that I was going to go on in. I was going to go in because with the way I was living, certainly wasn't a man. I wasn't taking care of Larry Jr. I wasn't doing anything. So anyway, I thought that I was going to be treated really well because I was almost a volunteer, you know? And so, next thing you know, I'm saying my goodbyes and I'm all important and people are feeling bad for me or sad for me and I'm going into the Army. Man, United States Army. That's me. So I go down there and they send me to Fort Ord, California, and then I kind of didn't understand. The way they talked to me, the way they yelled at us, they told us, get on that truck, you maggot. They called me a maggot. Do you know what a maggot is? And I'm thinking, I've seen a lot of maggots around my house, and they talk maggots. They calling me names. I'm thinking, wait a minute, you don't understand. I'm almost a volunteer. Man, I mean, you know, they used to, you know, you know what? It seemed like all my life in situations like that, they kind of just focused in on me. Now, I didn't know I was waving a flag all the time because I just wanted to ask questions when I should have just shut up. But anyway, here I am in this man's army, and they're taking me, and every time they see me, I'd walk, you know, when you come out of the barracks, you have to run. You can't walk anywhere. You got to run, you know. And I walk out, and I'd run. I'd really run. And the officers and the sergeant, they'd look at me, and they say, hey, you're not moving fast enough. Drop. And I'd have to get down and do these push-ups. And I hated them, and they hated me. And I wanted to tell them, but I knew better. And so here I am living in this thing. And then I remember it was time for the haircuts. And I had a little afro, you know. You can't tell it now, but I used to have hair. You understand, don't you, T? So anyway, I go there. Here I am. We do this thing, parade rest, and the guys are going in, and they're getting their haircuts, and they're coming out, and they're all bald. And I'm like, hey, man, when I go in there, I'm going to tell them just take a little off the side. You know? So it's my turn, and I walk in there, and when I get in there, I see how, man, they're not letting the guy say anything. They just put them in the chair, and and they're out less than 2 minutes. So now it's my turn. I say, hey, wait, and they say, shut up. And I say, hey, well, wait, and they throw me in the chair, and the next thing you know, I'm bald-headed. I didn't understand. And I came out, and that was my life in the military. All these things were going on, and man, then next thing you know, it's time for orders, and I'm thinking I'm going to Japan or Germany. Man, I'm going to see the world like they said, and I'm all excited about this thing. And then they give me these orders, and they tell me I'm going to Vietnam. And I said, whoa, hold it. This ain't what I'm almost a volunteering for. This is not good. No, not me. I don't know those people. I don't have anything to do with. No, I'm not going. And you know what I told everybody? There is no way in hell I'm going to Vietnam. I am. Let me make sure you hear me. I am not going to Vietnam. And then I remember when I was going over that big mountain in Japan headed for Vietnam. I again didn't understand. And then when we landed in Vietnam, we landed at night, and man, I'm telling you. Now, let me tell you and back up. I was drinking all the time, a lot. I even got to the place to where I was cool enough to where we would hustle up some money and go to the liquor stores and stand there for a nice guy to come by who would go in and buy us some whatever we wanted. We'd never get our change back, but that really didn't matter, you know? And so I was in the point to where now I could take a bottle of Ripple and put it in my pocket, and I thought it was cool walking down the street, talking to guys, and breaking out a bottle of Ripple and take. I thought that was cool. You know, I was coming up in life, and I started doing that. But I had swore that I would never ever do anything stronger than alcohol. That outside issues that we talk about around here, I call it drugs. I was never going to do that. And that weed that people were smoking, are they out of their mind? You know, what is wrong with them? And then when I landed in Vietnam, whatever you offered me, I do. Because it made me think better and I could hear better. I mean, that's what we thought. And then some things took place in Vietnam that, I said before, I wouldn't want to watch on TV today. One of the greatest things that happened to me, or the freedoms that I got when I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, is there's a part in this book that there says that there are some wrongs we can never fully right. But we won't worry about them if we could honestly say to ourselves we could write them if we could. And that's where I was. And that made me feel better because, you see, when you're in a situation like that and you're with a group of guys, a small group of guys, and something starts to go down, if you don't participate, they worry about you. And there are a lot of guys that don't come home not because of the enemy, but because of friendly fire, we call it. And so one of the things that happened is that then I thought it was important to participate. And I'm telling you that there are some scary things that can happen in an atmosphere like that. It is really, really strange. And I applaud all those guys that's going over there. And anyway, they come back, no matter how they get back, they're fortunate. Because a lot of my friends, I've watched them, they didn't come back. I go down sometimes and I go to the wall and I look at their names and I look at the names and I scratch it, and it takes me back to when we were there together doing the things we do. And when I came back, I decided that my life was going to change. You know, I was going to become a dealer, a drug dealer, because my wife had found somebody else. And somebody else was over my son. And I didn't understand. And I was going to make some changes, but what I wanted to let everybody in the world know that I was the man. You see, when I came back and I started doing or entering into that deal, what it was, I wanted everybody to know my name. When I think about it, that wasn't too smart. However, I had been places where the police began to know my name. I got picked up one time and they were taking me to jail. And when they were taking me to jail, I was looking at them. They drive me down to the police station. When they drive me down, I'm sitting in the car, you know, and all the other police officers are coming out. And they're looking at the car, and I'm thinking, Jesus, why are they looking at me? And they come up to the window, and they look at me, you know, and they just stare at me. And they shake their head, and they turn around and walk off. And, man, it was pissing me off. It was making me angry. And one came to the car, and he looked down at me. I said, what are you looking at? I ain't no damn monkey. And he looked like that, and he said, yeah, you're a monkey. You're in a cage, aren't you? And that was so real. That was so true. And I understood then powerlessness. Because he was able to truly call me a monkey, and he was really accurate. I made a couple more trips like that. So then what happened, now my wife and I had separated, and I'm now trying to run the streets carrying guns and I was trying to be a Wyatt Earp type guy, you know. And so I'm doing my thing. And so what happened, though, is that, listen, I know that my life wasn't right. I knew that. But when I talk to you, I tell you about how great things were, but you could see. And I decided to come down from L.A. to see my boy. I wanted to see my son, and I hadn't seen him in a long time. I certainly hadn't seen any money that way. But I went to the school that he was going to, and I walked up to the school, and I was looking in the door, and I was just, there he was, my son, Larry Jr. And the teacher saw me, and she came up to me, and she said, "Can I help you?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "No, I'm just looking at my boy." She said, "Which one?" I said, "Larry." She said, "Oh, Larry's your son. You're Mr. Dixon." I said, "Yeah." She said, "You know what, Mr. Dixon? Larry, I'm sure Larry's really a good boy, but sometimes I don't know what to do with him." And I said, "What?" She says, "Sometimes I can't control him." And something inside me started to boil, and I got pissed. And I said, "Can I talk to him?" She said, "Sure." So she walked into the classroom. And when she walked into the classroom, she bent down to tell him something. And he kind of glanced, and he saw me. And before she said anything else to him, no one had to give him permission. He jumped up, and he ran to me, and he grabbed me and said, "Dad, Dad." He was crying, saying, "Dad." And I was like, wow. And I pushed him back and said, hey, I hear you've been acting up in school, and I'm going to kick your butt. He said, okay, Dad, okay. And he grabbed me again. I was like, Jesus, what am I going to do? So I pushed him back. I said, you know what? I'm going to go see your mom. I think you should live with me. And he grabbed me and he was, oh, thank you, Dad. And I was thinking, what the heck did I just say? Where did that come from? But now, you know, I had to act like, okay, son, I'm going to talk to your mom. And I knew this girl, I mean, my wife, I'm telling you something. She ain't, you can't push her around. She didn't play that stuff, you know. And so I went to talk to her. And I said, hey, I said, when's the last time you went up to see your son? She said, what? I said, when's the last time you went to school to see about your son? And she said, when's the last time you sent some money this way? I said, well, wait, let's take first things first. I was ahead of my time, you know what I mean? I said, well, I'm talking about it. And, and then we started talking, and I said, you know what I think? I think I should keep him. I think he should live with me. And she looked at me and she said, really? You think you can handle that? And I said, yes, I think I can handle that. She said, she turned around. She didn't say another word. She walked into her bedroom. And when she came back, she had a bag. And she handed me the bag, and inside was his clothes. And I'm looking at her saying, whoa, I don't understand. Where's the fight? What's going on? So I'm looking in the bag, and I'm thinking, all right. And I'm thinking, I'm walking out to my car, and I know she'll catch me before I get my car. And then I get in the car, and I know the car never starts right up. So she'll have some time. And the car started. And I drove off wondering, what the hell did I do? And on that day, I became a single parent, and I had to change a lot of things. I had to put the guns away. I had to try to stop doing the things that I was doing. I think my son was the beginning of the saving of my life. So anyway, I became a single father and single parent, excuse me, and I started doing the best I could for him. And I remember there were a lot of times when I would try to make this soup and sandwich type of deal, and he would just look at me and say, Dad, can we please go to the Jack in the Box? I say, I'm doing the best I can, man, you know, and I was struggling. So anyway, I landed this job. And when I landed this job, what I did is I told him I wanted him to do something, go down to the Y, find some things that he can do, because I didn't want him at home by himself when I was at work. And my son went there, and when I came back, he wanted to be a boxer. He said, Dad, they got a boxing team. I said, you're out of your mind, man. You don't want to do that. But he did, and he became a boxer. And at a very young age, he became a champion. He was really good. He represented the United States against Russia, Sweden, a lot of countries. He was on the Olympic team. And while he was doing that, though, I want to tell you that at a lot of these great big tournaments, I had come into AA, but you guys showed up, and I couldn't make it. I didn't know how to represent. I was drinking and doing some of that other stuff. People, his coach would come and say, hey, Larry, he said, you know, your son is really good, man. You're going to miss it. And I'd look at him like, what are you talking about? But he could see that I was going downhill, and he knew why. So I was doing this stuff. But anyway, let me fast forward, because we're really getting short here. And I just want to tell you that I went through a lot of little things like that that didn't seem to fit for me, and I didn't understand. And I knew I wasn't living right. And so what happened was that in 1984, I decided to commit suicide. And when I tried to commit suicide, I decided to do it in my way. I went down to a hotel room on Pacific Coast Highway, and I had all this cocaine. I had this alcohol. I had Run 51 rum, Tanqueray. I was going to have a party, and I was going to take myself out. Nobody knew where I was. And I'd worked for this company called Coca-Cola, and I was going to go out and teach the world to sing, but I didn't know how. And so I always think of it. Sometimes I really get it, because I got a friend back there, John, and John and I used to hang out, and when I would come up missing for days at a time, I wouldn't go home. I'd get my paycheck, I wouldn't go home, and John would go looking for me. People would really look for me to try to bring me home, but I was just stupid. I was dumb. I didn't know how to live. And so what happened is that on this time when I decided to commit suicide, I go into this place and I'm going to take myself out, and that didn't work. I was there. I went on a Wednesday. No one knew where I was. And on Saturday, I was out of everything. I didn't have any more money to pay for another night's room. And I couldn't go out and run in front of a car. There was all kind of things. I was just messed up. And the reason why I'm saying all this, and you probably have heard stories like this, and, you know, it's just garbage. It's really garbage, and it's not important to you. But I think it's important for me to remind myself of where I was, because sometimes I still forget. And I think that I deserve more than what I have. And when I look back, I don't deserve nothing. In fact, I got a lot more than I deserve. And what happened was that I fell into the rooms of AA. And so what happened is that this girl, I was in and out, in and out. I was a newcomer again and again from 1984, because I didn't come. I went into a hospital from 1984 to 1988. I was in and out people, a lot of people in this room know me and remember me. There's Larry again. Hope he gets saved before he dies. And I didn't understand. And then there was this girl in the meeting I used to go to at the Lemon Grove Alano Club. And I knew without a shadow of a doubt that she did not like me. Her name was Linda. She was a school teacher. And she was so smart. When she'd get up, she could talk well. You can hear how I don't speak that well. The English language was really not that important to me when I was coming up, bruh, you know, and what up, you know. And so what happened was that, so now she would watch me when I was sharing. Every time I'd go to share, I'd look at her and I'd say, would she stop looking at me? And so anyway, this one time I came in, I was a newcomer, and I swore I wasn't going to tell you. I was going to get 30 days under my belt before I told anybody, because I didn't want to go through that stuff again, because I didn't want you to come up and say, what step were you on when you relapsed, all that crap, you know? I didn't want to hear that. I'm not on a step, damn it. Can you do it? So anyway, I go in there, and I raise my hand. I raise my hand again, and when I raise my hand, she looks at me. Well, I'm not going to tell you, but they said, are there any newcomers in here? And I said, hi, I'm... Oh, my, what did I do? And she looked at me, and when she looked at me, I looked at her. And I stared at her like I thought she was staring at me. And she got up, and she started coming my way. And I said, I'm going to let her have it. I'm not up for that today. So if she want to approach me, she's going to get a rude awakening. And she came to me and she stood right in front of me. She said, can I talk to you for a minute? I said, sure. We stepped outside and I started swelling up like a peacock. And she looked at me and she said, Larry, you know, I've been thinking about you. And every time you come in and out, she says, you know, you worry me. And she says, and this time I look at you and you look like death. She says, so what I did is I made a list of all the meetings that I'm going to go to. And every meeting I go to, I'm going to save a seat for you for 15 minutes. And if you show up, you got to see. But if you don't, it's okay. I'll love you anyway. And I looked at her. And she just gave me a hug. And she stepped back and she said, Larry, please don't die on us. And she turned around and she walked away. And I couldn't go back in that room because image was a lot to me. And I didn't want you guys to see me crying. I didn't understand that. This blonde-haired woman, school teacher, told me that. And then the thing that really confused me is that the next meeting I was there sitting next to her. And I started following her around like I was a puppy. And then she came up and she said to me, we've been doing some things. And one guy, I was sitting in a seat, and this guy came up to me and he says, hey, Larry, how is it out there? And I looked at him and I was getting ready to say something. And she says, you SOB, why don't you get the hell out of here? If you want to know how it is out there, take your out there. And I'm looking at her saying, hey, I can fight my own battles. You know, I looked at her and I said, hey, wait a minute. And she said, F you, Larry. And I'm like, whoa. She said, you just sit there and be quiet for a minute. And I said, okay. And she went back to this guy, and this guy says, whoa. You know, and he backed off and he walked away. And I looked at her and said, why did you do that? She said, because, you know what, when you're man enough to talk to people the way you feel, then I'll let you take care of yourself. But until then, I'll take care of you. You know you didn't like what he said. And I'm sitting there saying, okay. I started going to meetings. And then what happened was part of the greatest part of my life is that she brought me into the meetings called the East Side Group. And you guys know a lot of the meetings I went to. But I went to the East Side Group, and my friend Ben was the secretary. And she said, Larry, you like Ben. Why don't you go up to him and ask him to help you be your sponsor? I said, all right. So I'm thinking, how do you do this crap? Sponsor. How do I be a sponsor? So I walked over to him. And I said, hey, man, listen, I'm thinking about taking the steps. I was wondering if you could help me take the steps. He said, yeah, you know, after this meeting, we'll go over to my house and we'll get started. I'm like, whoa, not now. Why is everybody in such a hurry? So I'm thinking, oh, man, I asked him, I got to do it. And so I followed this guy over to his house, and he spent some time with me the best he could, and he did some things. And that brings me to something that's very important to me that I hear go around these rooms, and they say we have no opinion, but I got an opinion on this, and I just think it's important for me to share. Sometimes I hear some jerk, and that's what I call them. They could come talk to me if they don't like it. But I heard these people come up and say, I fired my sponsor. I fired my sponsee, and man, Man, I just want to jump up and say, are you out of your damn mind? I wish somebody would come up to me and tell me they fired me. Before they can fire me, I want my 2-week severance. I want vacation pay. And if you can, don't you ever, ever have the audacity to come up to me and talk fire. And I would never do that. I moved on. I've had a couple of sponsors, but I never fired any of them. And they were all just as important to me as today as they was then when I was down on my knees, begging for help, looking up and not being able to see the bottom. Knew what your shoes looked like, but had no idea what your eyes look like. I was worth less than everything and everybody when I came in here. I had a brown car with a blue fender. Many of you know about that car. Somebody stole that car. I couldn't believe they... I just didn't understand. This is the kind of car that if you walk by, if the window's down, you would throw money into it, you know? It looked worse than any of these guys that sit on the corner and say, we'll work for food. It was a bad car. It was a terrible car. And somebody stole that car. And someone told me, pray for it. Just pray. Pray. And you know what? He brought my car back. That pissed me more off than when they stole it. I couldn't believe that they, what are they saying? But anyway, to get to the real meat of it, and I want to tell you quickly because I only got a minute or two, but it's very important that you understand something here, that Alcoholics Anonymous not only saved my life, it saved my family's life. I have been in this room and I've gone through a lot of things, and many of you know you've reached out and touched me in ways that I'll never be able to repay. The only thing that I can do is turn around and touch somebody else if I can, if God will allow me to do that. I'm very sure, and I've been told that what happens is that I could come in here and sit in one of these chairs, and I could come here every Saturday, but that won't make me a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I could go sit in a chicken coop and be in there for a year, and I guarantee you, when I come out, I could go bah, 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 and I can make the sound, and you'll look at me, and I'll say, I'm a chicken. You say, you ain't a damn chicken till you can lay an egg. And I want you to know that when you become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, you will do some things that they call is inconvenient for you. They call it service. It means that you will come in here, and I am blessed because I know about this meeting, and I know the heart and soul that have gone into putting this meeting on. I know what it's about of getting this podium like it is. I know what it's about the tape. I know how hard Terry, I want to thank you and Randy for asking me to be a speaker here because I'm truly blessed. I feel that I'm part of the in crowd. I'm part of the in crowd. It wasn't like that before I came into AA. Since I've come into AA, I've lost my brother, who was that older brother, and I've also lost my sister. And every time when that happened, you were there for me. You told me I didn't have to drink no matter what. You told me that if I just held on to you, you wouldn't let me go. And even though you look at me and know that when I first came here looking at you, I didn't think I fit. I always knew that there was going to come a time when you say, hey, Larry, why don't you go to your meeting? But you never did that. You guys showed up at my brother's funeral, my sister's funeral. They didn't even know you, but you were there because you knew me. Then my mother got sick. She had cancer. And I was trying to take care of her as best I could. I was missing work, and you recognized that. And what you did is the women in this program set up a schedule. They didn't know my mother, but they knew me, and they set up a schedule so that they would be there from 6 to 9, then be relieved from 9 to 12, and did that so I could go to work and take care of my family. Women came over and helped me fix the toilet in my mother's house at 10:30 at night when I'm laying up there failing, woe with me. They say, men work with men and women work with women, and I'm saying alcoholics work with alcoholics, and that we have a responsibility that when the hand reaches out, we have to be there. I'm telling you that I don't know where I would be today. People say jails, institutions of death, but I don't know which one of them I would have taken on if it wasn't for you. You guys have shown me more love. My kids, I mean, I got kids that my oldest son, the one that was a boxer, was over at the house. He brought his 3 grandkids over to my house to make cookies. Man. My kids, I have a cell phone, and it's not for those other issues or things. It's for my family. It's for my friends like you, and it's on 24 hours, and I answer the phone. I've had a chance to go to some of those prisons and things and see people who are in there that's going to be there for a long time, and they did what I did, but they got caught. And I get to come here on a Saturday night and say how much I love you and how much I appreciate you. There were some people in here that I just want to recognize that is very important to me. And that's Mark, Renee, Tony, and John. You guys stood up and you said that you were newcomers. And you know that I'm telling you the truth when I tell you I love you. And then I hope you can find what I found in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because you deserve to have a better life. And I'm going to leave you with a story here. And I hope it's not one. I hope it's one that John will agree with or be okay with. But what happened, there was this father who had this thing. He was a single parent. He had this little kid that was 4 years old, you know, and the kid would always say he had lost his job through drinking and drugging and doing all those things. And the son would always come up to his dad and say, "Dad, you never play with me anymore. Dad, how come you don't play with me?" And the father looked at him and said, "Okay, son, here, listen, do this. Go in your room and play for 15 minutes and your dad will play your game with you." And he said, "Oh, thank you, Dad." And he grabbed his dad and he ran in the room. You could hear him jumping up and down on the bed saying, "My dad's going to play with me. My dad's going to play with me." He heard that. He said, "What happened to me? I love that boy. What happened to me? All these things that's going on." And he was just boo-hooing when the little kid came out and said, "Okay, Dad, it's been 15 minutes. You promised." And he looked at his son and he was going to make up another excuse to get some more time. He looked down and on the floor there was a magazine. And on the cover of the magazine there was a picture of the world. So he grabbed the world and he tore it up into little pieces and scattered it all out like it was a puzzle. He said, "Okay, son, we're going to play my game first. When you put that puzzle back together, then we'll play your game." And the little boy said, "Oh, thank you, Dad." And he grabbed his dad and he hugged him. He was so happy. He jumped down there. And his father said, "Oh, my, what am I doing? He'll never be able to do it." And he went in the room and he was thinking about how terrible he was and how he would do. How would he do his son like that? When the little boy came in and said, "Okay, Dad, it's my turn." And he looked at his son. He said, "What?" He said, "It's my turn, Dad." He said, "What do you mean? What about the world?" He said, "The world's back together. Dad, come see." And he took his father by the hand, and the world was perfect. And he looked down at the world, and he looked at his little four-year-old boy, and he said, "How did you do that?" And the little boy said, "Dad, it was real easy. You see, Dad, on the other side of the world, there was a picture of a man. And when I put the man back together, the world just fell into place. When I got to AA, my sponsor told me, because when he asked me, he said, 'What is your date, Larry?' And I said, 'It was Thursday.' He said, 'Wow, man, that's awesome.' I said, 'What? What?' He said, 1-1-2-2-8-8. And I said, 'The hell is wrong with him?'" And I walked away and I'm sitting there all through the meeting. And all I could think about is 1-1-2-2. What the hell is he talking about? And what he was talking about is that my sobriety date is November 22nd. 1988, 1-1-2-2-8-8. And you know, I have a beautiful home now and I have a nice car. My family's doing very well. We're getting ready to celebrate a Christmas and it's wonderful. But I want you to know from the bottom of my heart that I can lose all those, and I know that. But the thing that I will never, ever lose that you can't take from me is 1-1-2-2-8-8. Now, if I'm fool enough to give it up, that world will no longer be together. AA has helped me put my world together. And I tell you from the very bottom of my heart, thank you so much. I love you and I wish you a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. Thank you.